What we started looking at was what we called the big boat, big tower, big city, the flood, Babel, Sodom, and Gomorrah. And so we kind of looked at the background for these last week that it had to do with individuals that were determining not to do God's will, people that were exchanging the truth regarding God for the lie. And so we were looking at why that was important, why this is a story that we ought to know. You could probably do this with anything that God relates in His Word. You could say, this is why you ought to know this. God didn't just put it in here, you know, to fill space. So that's one of the things. But I think it is helpful because sometimes we as believers, we don't know why a story is important. We read, and I have things in the Word that I read sometimes. I just read a passage the other day that I was like, why did God include that in there? I don't even understand what the significance of that is. And it's a passage in the Old Testament, but I'm like, even at that time that it was written, I don't know what the significance of that would have been for those people. What difference did it make? Anyway, but so we're trying to do that. So under B down there, if you want to start filling some of these in, we're going to look at the fact that God intervened when the majority openly conflicted with God or an anti-God behavior became the norm. Perhaps accepted or even praised. And I want to look at a passage of Scripture that is not on your outline, but I want you to look with me in Romans chapter 1. And when you get there, I want you to turn to the end of the chapter. Now, last week we looked at three passages here in Romans 1 that looked at this downward progression of mankind. And that downward progression culminates, and I'm just going to read through these. I don't want to get into interpreting what's going on here, but in verse 28 following, it says, just as they did not see fit to, verse 29 is the one I want to go, being filled with all unrighteousness. And we've told you before, I think there ought to be a colon following that. Everything else following is an example of unrighteousness. And that unrighteousness would be wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slanders, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrusting, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know then the ordinance or the I don't have the Greek in front of me. I can't remember what the word is. We're just going to go with ordinance. I can't remember what the word is. Ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death. So if you practice these things, you're worthy of death. But, then he goes on, and they not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. And the Greek actually would seem to indicate that it's not just a matter of the people, it's not just people that are worthy of death or those that practice it, but the Greek, I think, goes a little different direction the New American Standard has chosen to go. It's that also those people that approve of that behavior, even though they don't do it. And so, yeah, we see this in our society today. Well, that's not for me, but it's okay for them. And granted, within Christianity, within the Christian life, are there some, I don't want to use the term situational ethics because that has a real bad ring to it, but are there some things that that sometimes are wrong and sometimes aren't wrong? Yeah. There are things that God says, this is okay. If you think you can do it, it's okay. To yourself, it's fine. Paul says, to the one that it is unclean, to them it's unclean. But if it's clean to somebody, then it's okay. And he's not talking about these things. He's talking about some other matters. I'm just trying to indicate there are some things that depend on the level of maturity where you're at. This, on the other hand, is looking at people that look at this behavior and say, well, I don't do that kind of thing. But if that's what's good for them and they're fulfilled with that, then that's okay. And Paul is saying here, not only are the people that practice these things worthy of death, but also those that even though they don't practice it, they approve of it. They say it's okay. They also are worthy of death. And I think more so we're seeing in our own individual culture this very attitude, which may be in line with what we're looking here, may be an indicator of where we're going and things that may come. I'm not saying will, but may come. as a result of the fact that our culture increasingly people are saying, people are doing more and more things that maybe at one time were not acceptable, at least not to do openly, but also that we're seeing a culture which increasingly is approving of people doing things even if they don't do it. So we're going to be looking at this idea. We come down here and point number one, we have a modern tendency to apologize, and this is one example, because it goes with these particular three things, with the flood, Babel not so much, but with Sodom and Gomorrah. Babel, there wasn't death. There was death involved with the flood. There's death involved in Babel. And today, the modern tendency is to Sodom and Gomorrah, thank you. The modern tendency is to apologize for God instructing genocide or inflicting genocide. Probably in this case, it would be more the case. But this is going to carry over into, in fact, I have an aunt that's a believer that I remember her telling me this, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And she says, these people thought that God wanted them to kill everybody. And I said, they didn't think God wanted to kill them. God told them to. She goes, why would God do that? Why would God tell them to kill all these other nations? Every man, woman, and child. It wasn't like, just kill the bad men. It's like, you went in and you wiped everybody out. Well, that's what God did with the flood. That's what God did with Sodom and Gomorrah. And what we're going to see is, oftentimes in our culture, we are so far removed, we do not appreciate how vile the actions of these people were. And to give an illustration of this, back, I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever it was, Peg and I had watched a show that they had on ABC News one night in which they showed, they had people that had filmed World War II, cameramen that had actually taken film footage of different things from World War II. And one of the things that they showed, and then it was interesting because one of the students actually, they taped this off the TV, brought it in, and the history teacher, government teacher at that time, had all his kids watch that, no matter what class they were taking from him the next day, because he thought this was all good. Because, again, we were in the 2000s at the time, and a lot of these kids are so far removed from the real concept of what war really looks like and what's going on, and they have no idea. It's back there. It's glamorized with Rambo and these nut jobs and everything like that. And one of the things that was really amazing was they showed video footage that they took of a German community that the Allies took the German community and made every man and woman that lived in that town, not the kids, but man and woman, go outside, go out to the concentration camp where they had killed Jews and unacceptable individuals, people with different physical disabilities and stuff, and killed all these people out in this concentration camp and made them walk through and look at everything. Because all these people said, oh, they didn't even know it was there. They didn't even know it was in their backyard. And maybe they didn't know it was in their backyard. But what they found out is a lot of these people did know to some degree. There were rumors of what was going on. They just didn't want to admit it. And that's an example of the fact that's something vile. And we don't like to think that people have actually done really vile things, such as gassing whole people and burning them and all the stuff that went on there. So with that in mind, I want you to look with me at Deuteronomy chapter 12. And I want to provide, I think, a little biblical justification for what God does in these instances. Some of this you have gone over because some of this we have looked at when we went through the minor prophets. So Deuteronomy chapter 12, look with me at verses 29. Beginning with verse 29 down through verse 31, it says, and when the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods that I also may do likewise? In other words, that verse is very important because every culture had its gods or has its gods, and every culture has its way that you worship those gods. How do you do service to them? And that's what he says. Don't go in and serve the gods they served, and don't try to figure out, well, how did they serve their gods so that we can do it like them? You shall not, verse 31, do. New American Standard has behave, but it's simply the Hebrew word asa. It's just to do. You shall not do it in this way. The Lord your God, or toward the Lord your God, for every abominable act. I actually spent quite a bit of time going over this word abominable act. It's a word that in the Hebrew meant something that causes horror, something that causes revulsion, the kind of thing that you see it and you're going, oh, I don't want to look at that. That was the idea of this word. And it's applied to, I think as I went through all the places where this word occurs in the Old Testament, curse applies to about four specific different areas. One of them had to do with sacrifices. One of it had to do with simply bowing down to the God. One of them had to do with, to be very frank, sexual practices that were done in the worship of those gods, both heterosexual and homosexual. And one of them had to do with one of the things we're going to look at here, the sacrifice of children. And all four of those things are indicated as abominable acts that these people were practicing. He says, don't do these abominable acts. We think of abominable and, you know, the only thing I knew abominable when I was a kid was the abominable snowman. But literally that word, the Hebrew one, meant the horrific acts. Put that word in there. The horrific acts, the things that cause you to be revulsed and repulsed and go, oh, it's awful. He says, the acts for which God hates. Notice, God hates these acts. It's not just, these are not nice things. God hates these. When God says he hates something, you better pay attention because it's going to be showing you something serious. Okay? It's showing you something serious. That they have done for their gods. For, notice verse 31, for they even burned their sons and daughters in the fire of their gods. In other words, he's saying, that's how deplorable, how revulsive their actions or their conduct was. All these other things we may look at that, oh, that's gross, that's disgusting. But burning your children, that just shows you how far this went. Now, turn...
In our own culture, you know, that we hear about abortion, but and I think it's kind of like those people who said that we know what's going on, but you don't really, without seeing it graphically, you don't really understand until you see pictures of like late-term abortions, and you see dismembered babies that are just developed almost all the time. And people are like, oh, well, you know, life goes on. Yeah, life goes on, but I'm sure God doesn't like that.
And I think you're looking at a situation, again, that's one of those things I think it would fall in there, that's how far does our culture go before God might intervene? It's one of the contrasts between where things were and where things are, is that God might intervene, but he may not at the present time in culture. I think there is some evidence that he still does, based on something that Paul says, but we're going to wait till we get there. Look back to Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15, and there's a statement that he makes when God is promising to Abraham this land. Okay, he's promising this specific land. Verse 18, it says, and on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenanite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, and the Amorite, the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. Now that's the land that he was promising them. But I want you to go back up to verse 16, and I want you to notice what God says about this land now. It says, then in the fourth generation... Verse 16, and in the fourth generation, they shall return here for, now most of your English Bibles are going to say the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete, it's not yet filled full. And that word iniquity we've talked about before, it's the Hebrew word awen, which means perversity. It is always, as I found it in the Old Testament, always a reference to some activity from the sin nature. They did have a concept of the sin nature in the Old Testament, and they can't translate it there's two different Hebrew words that are related, but these two different Hebrew words, awa and awen, that represent perversity. And most of the time, they're translated iniquity in your English Bibles. But they're references to what we would call the sin nature. And he says, what God is saying, and this is the way I would understand this statement in verse 16. God knows, because of his plan and because of his omniscience, I would say the two go hand in hand. God knows, Abraham, what these people are doing now is bad, but it's not as bad as it's going to be. When it reaches a point at which it is as bad as I'm going to tolerate, that's when I will step in and I will dispossess them from the land and you will take over. Now you'd say, well, why doesn't God step in right now? I would state, I really think God is a God that on behalf of mankind, I hate to say gives us the benefit of the doubt, but I would say does give his creation time to change. And I think he's giving them this period of time for them to change, but God knows they're not going to change. But he's given it so nobody can say, well, they could have changed. And God goes, I gave them, and he actually indicates the amount of time that these people were going to be down in Egypt for 400 years, and then in the fourth generation, they're going to come back. So 400 years and these four generations following, they're going to have plenty of time to do what? To change. And they're not going to have changed. Would you say 400 years is time to change? Should be. We've got a country now that we voted our current president in because, we can do it. Yes, we can. They all wanted change. They all believed he could change it in 4 or 8 years. So here's an example that God is justified. We're not defending God. We are demonstrating from the Word of God why God does this. For us, so that we don't wrongfully make accusations or wonder in our mind, God, that doesn't seem very fair on God's part. And I honestly didn't know. I remember when my aunt had asked me this question all those years ago. I'd read through the Old Testament, but I guess I didn't realize how horrible some of these people were. I just figured, well, they're just bad, unsaved people. I didn't realize how bad they were. It really was horrible, the things that they were perpetrating in the name of their religions. Okay, so God did this so that Israel would be encouraged. Then, furthermore, that Israel would be encouraged not to intimidate the actions of the people around them. That's at the time of Deuteronomy. Okay, now the other thing I want you to look at Genesis 22, because I want to notice something. And if you have you don't have the same page ready, so you might not have this. Yeah, you do. On page 8, under B, and C, it says, God distinguished himself from the false. You'd make me feel better if you take that capital G and make it a small g. I noticed that on my sheet that I had done that wrong. But if you look at Genesis chapter 22, most of us, if you've got a good study Bible, they have a reference, and it tells us, verse 2, well, let's go to verse 1. Now, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham, said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Now, you know what? You and I look at this and see, we got to put this in perspective. Do you ever read this and think, and Abraham just did this? Abraham obeyed. And he did obey, but we still are sometimes shocked that he would obey. But keep in mind, Abraham was living in a culture in which this was normal. All the people around him were worshiping gods that always were asking for child sacrifices. So they had guys all around them. And the thing is, in the Baal worship of these cultures, in Baal worship, you offered your firstborn son. You took your firstborn male child, and that was the one that you offered. In fact, I think I may have bored you with details on this, but Hamilcar Barca, the king in North Africa, I can't remember the city that was in North Africa up there, but he's the father of Hannibal. Anyway, you know, Hannibal that took the elephants and went over and came against Rome. His father, Hamilcar Barca, had hundreds of children burned in sacrifice so that he didn't have to have his son Hannibal sacrificed to Baal. Could you imagine that? You're the king, so I can buy my God off by sacrificing a whole bunch of other people's kids. And I think I told you that in the excavation in that city, I can't remember what the name of the city is across North Africa, but in the excavations of that ancient city, they have found ossuary jars with the burned bones of over 17,000 children already. That's just in that city. And those are just the ones they've excavated. So it just shows you how common this was. Of course, everybody says today, well, no, that's what they did with the children when they died. They burned them. No, we know historically. But modern people want to think, oh, they weren't that horrible. They weren't that horrible. So they try to excuse them and say, they did that once in a while, but it wasn't very common. Exactly, that's as Ed was saying. So, I mean, we think we're so civilized and we try to excuse them. No. But what's amazing here is as Abraham's willing to do this, but what does God do? He goes down and let's go down to verse 10. It says, and Abraham stretched out his hand, took the knife to slay his son, and the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And then God provides a ram as an offering in verse 13. This is what God does, and this is important. God distinguishes him from the false gods of these other people by saying, I don't want you to offer your son as an offering. I don't want you to take your firstborn. In fact, if you remember, and we're not going to go through this, but when you get under the law, what did every Israelite do with their firstborn male child? They redeemed him. They actually took an animal and slew an animal in his place, because God says, I don't want you to kill your child. I'm not like those false gods that wants you to kill, and granted, we all know they're not innocent, but for practical purposes, we'd say an innocent life. The child has of yet not wielded a knife and done anything vile to anybody. And God didn't want that. See? So God distinguishes himself. And I think that that's important for us to grasp. Turn over to Exodus 34. I do have this note here on this, and we'll just kind of hit these verses real quick. Exodus 34, verses 19 through 20. And it says, you shall... do I have the right verse here? Yeah, okay. Yeah, verse 19. There it is. I was going to the wrong verse. Verse 19. The firstborn offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock, the first offspring from cattle and sheep, you shall redeem with a lamb, the first offspring from a donkey, and if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. In other words, every firstborn, even of your animals, you were supposed to redeem them. Even of your animals. Now, if you had a firstborn lamb or a firstborn cow, a male, that'd be a bull, those could be killed. If you had a working animal, such as a donkey, then you could actually offer another lamb in its place so that you could keep it as a working animal. But this is what they were supposed to do. This is what God sets up as a precedent. Now, I'm not going to drag you through all these verses because it's just depressing, in my opinion. But I gave you, if you want these, and I'm just trying to look, I didn't put all these on here, but I have under here that the Gentiles, they burned their sons and daughter. The king of Moab burned his son, 2 Kings 3:27. King Ahaz of Judah around 730, he was doing that, and I've got scriptures of that. Manasseh, king of Judah, he did the same thing. In fact, one of the reasons, and if you take, flip over, we will look at this one, 2 Kings 17. I'm just trying to show you how this what this culture was. And this ended up, what we're looking at is pre-law, but we're looking at Israel under the law, and we're looking at that they adopted the culture of these other people, the very thing that God's trying to take care of. Verse 17, it says, and they made their sons and their daughters pass through the fire and practiced divination, enchantments, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. And he's giving the reasons why Israel was taken away into Assyrian captivity, never to return. They haven't returned yet. God will bring them back in his time, but they're still in that captivity. Okay? And Jeremiah tells us, and I don't know if I have these verses for you on here. I should look. I thought I had them on here. Jeremiah, you can just mark these down. Jeremiah 7:30 through 31. and 19:4-5, Jeremiah tells us that it wasn't just the kings that were doing this, even the common people. That is, people like us, your average everyday Israeli. Even they were offering their children in the fire. Okay. Now let's go to Jonah. Let's look at Jonah. Let's jump ahead and look at this situation. Jonah and Nineveh. Turn over to Jonah chapter 1. There's two prophets that address the problem of Nineveh. And Jonah's, of course, the first one. And then Nahum is the second. And Nahum's written about 100 years after the time of Jonah. But God says he's going to send Jonah what? Verse 1 of Jonah chapter 1. And the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." Now, the wickedness coming up before me, that's a really visual idea to understand, as these people did, that God was so high above and removed from the people that if you could do some wickedness that actually would ascend so high up there that God would take notice of it, that was serious. Now, did God know it if they did one little evil thing? No, well, sure he did. But by saying, "It has come to my attention, it has come up to me," it's like saying, "This is so bad, I have taken notice of it." Okay. From here, I want you to go over to, and he doesn't, the thing is, he doesn't indicate what the wickedness was. But if you go over to Nahum, just a couple chapters later, or a couple books later, excuse me, Nahum chapter 3, which again is a book against Nineveh, and you can read that in verse 1, the oracle or the burden, the weight that is against Nineveh is the idea. That's chapter 1, verse 1. But chapter 3 now, it says, "Woe to the," notice, "the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillaging." See how he describes it? Nineveh is wicked because they were a bloody city, implying 3:1. Did I say, I might have said 3:5. 3:1. It's a bloody city. And then furthermore, the noise of the whip, obviously not being used against the animals, and the noise of the rattling wheel and the galloping horse, talking about driving animals on terms of pillaging and things, and bounding chariots, horsemen charging, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, masses of corpses, countless dead bodies. See how he's just kind of, everything's rather blunt or just kind of rather short. This. This is, he's tallying up the charges against them. They stumble over the dead bodies. In other words, he's saying Nineveh is responsible for killing so many people that there's so many piles, you stumble all over them. You can't walk. Verse 4, "And also because of the harlotries of the harlot, charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries." And understand when it's talking, usually when it's talking about harlotry, it's talking about spiritually selling yourself to these other gods as though you're selling yourself or buying a prostitute. It's what it's doing. It's comparing going to these gods like that. But it's also very visual because oftentimes some of that activity was involved in going to those gods. And then verse 5, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord, and I will lift up your skirts over your face and show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your disgrace." Oh, I wanted to quit with verse 4, I'm sorry. Anyway, he's telling what he's going to punish. But God's going to punish them for this because they were a bloody city. Because they were responsible for so much violence. Keep in mind, Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. They're the empire that actually God is going to use to come down and take the 10 northern tribes away in punishment. But they were a very aggressive empire. They're going to end up, in the end, falling to, because of a conflict with Egypt, they're going to end up falling to the Babylonians. And the Babylonians are going to take over as the fierce empire, even more fierce than the Assyrians. Okay, but that was Nineveh, and that's why God sent them. Why would God bother sending a prophet like Jonah? Let's go back to Jonah for a minute, because I think that this bears out why God was giving the Amorites time, and why he sends Jonah here, and the people change, and they change, and they last at least 100 years until Nahum prophesies against them. But look at the last verse of Jonah chapter 4. He says, Jonah, you had compassion over this plant in verse 10. And he says, should I, this is Jonah 4:11, should I not have had compassion on Nineveh, the great city, in which there are more than, notice this now, 120,000 persons who do not know between their right hand and their left hand, as well as many animals. In other words, he says, there's so many innocents in this city. I mean, he's talking about children that haven't yet figured out what the right hand and the left hand are yet. 120,000 children at that age. What age would that have to be? Most kids probably figure that out about 5, maybe, unless they're bright. Okay, then maybe they figure it out at 3 or 4, but most kids about 5. So you're saying kids, 120,000 children under 5. God says, shouldn't I have had compassion on them? And I think that that's demonstrating that even though God brings judgment against these, God still remains a compassionate God. And instead of just coming and just wiping out Nineveh, he at least sends a warning through Jonah. And the people do change. In fact, it's interesting. I'm actually working on a completely different study that we're doing somewhere else on faith. And this is one of the few passages in the Old Testament that says that people believe without a sign. And it's Gentiles. And it says they believed. The people of Nineveh did. I was just amazed that they believed his report. And they changed. Israel didn't believe. Even when God did signs before them, they didn't believe. Here a Gentile city at least believed. And they changed, and shall we say, they, by doing so, they delayed the judgment of God on Nineveh by about 100 years. About 100 years they delayed it. But again, I think that this is an illustration that even though God has brought judgment in the flood, though God has brought judgment at Babel, though God has brought judgment at Sodom and Gomorrah, it's not as though God hasn't given warnings and given them time to change. Okay? I don't want to jump ahead. There's a couple other things we could bring about. Turn back over to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18, and let's, Genesis chapter 18, look at verse 23. This is when Abraham, or God has appeared to Abraham with two angels, when Abraham is at Mamre. And let's see, I've got some verses on here, but let's go to verse 16. Then the men rose up from there and looked down toward Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Because Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation. And in him, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, in order that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. And the Lord said, so now he's going to tell him, Abraham, this is the deal. The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. Kind of similar to what we had over with Jonah and Nahum. Their outcry has actually risen to me. It's so great, I've heard it. It's not that, and again, God, it's not that God didn't know it from the first little bad thing that was done, but if he's just saying, normally in their culture, they thought gods didn't take notice of them because gods were like kings. They were so aloof. If you have a little fight with your wife or with your neighbor, that's not a big deal. But if your evil spreads and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, well, then your god or your king takes notice. Then he steps in. But I'm not going to quibble with little stuff. So when God says this, God's simply saying this in terms of the way these people understood that. This has gotten so bad that God's taken notice of it, okay? Because that's the way they would have understood this. So he says, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great. Verse 21, I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. If not, I will know. Now, does God know what's going on down there? Yeah, but you know what he's going to do? He's going to give the people, I believe what he's really indicating, he's going to give them a chance to actually prove straightforward with the presence of his angels there, are you going to do it now? Are you going to do that right now? Or the presence of these unusual men, are you going to step back and behave like you should? That's what he's doing here. It's not that God's going, well, I'm going to go down and check it out because I don't know. Remember, we're talking about an omniscient God. But people come and read these passages and go, see, back at this time, when they wrote about God, they didn't know if God knew about everything. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, I'm going to go down and I'm going to check this out in person. I know what's going on, but I'm going to show up and see if it's different when I'm there. Verse 22, and the men turned away from there and they went towards Sodom while Abraham was standing before the Lord. And Abraham came near, and I want to read now the rest of this, and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Now, this is an important question to ask. And when we, as we go on with this study, not tonight, but before we're done, this is one of the things we're going to have to answer. Is God going to sweep up? Let's say if God did intervene in our country. Let's say God decided to do something. Would he sweep us away with the rest of the punishment that he's bringing up? This is the question, okay, that Abraham wants to know. And it's the same kind of question people today want to know. Okay, so verse 24. Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal righteously or justly? And the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I'll spare the whole place on their account. Abraham answered and said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Got down to 45 now. You destroy the whole city because of that 5? And he says, I will not destroy it if I find 45. He spoke to him again. Suppose 40 are found there. And he says, I will not do it on account of the 40. And he says, oh, may the Lord not be angry. I shall speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he says, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, now behold, if I venture to speak to the Lord, suppose 20 are found there. He says, I will not destroy it on account of the 20. Then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry. And I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed and Abraham returned to his place. What he's saying, he says, if there's 10 in the city, well, is he going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? We all know the story, yeah. Which is telling you what? They're not 10 righteous people in that city. Not 10 righteous people. Isn't that an amazing thing? I've heard, by the way, I've listened to pastors that have railed on Lot, saying, how could Lot live in that vile city? Lot was a compromiser. He was a vile man. But you know what the New Testament calls him? 3 times. It calls him righteous. And it tells us that he living in that city, it says his soul was vexed. His soul was burdened. He hated to see the stuff. They would say, why didn't he move out? Well, there's a lot of people we could ask that same question across America. Why are you living where you're living? Why are you living where you're living?
Why are you going to the church?
Yeah. There's all kinds of questions you could ask like that. And actually, Peter actually says God rescued Lot out of there, proving God rescues the righteous out of these things, which is exactly what Abraham said. You're not going to sweep them away. In fact, he says, you won't destroy the city if there are 10 there. Okay, there's not 10, but I will rescue the one that is righteous out of it. He doesn't say Lot's wife is righteous. He doesn't say his son-in-laws are righteous. And he doesn't say his daughters are righteous. But Lot is. Lot, he says, is righteous in this. Okay.
Related to that, in Israel's numerous, where they were crushed over and over and over, is there any indication, I don't recall any verses where God said, there are this many righteous, so then, because obviously Israel repeatedly was crushed, were there not even a handful of righteous in Israel? There must have been some.
But again, I think it's the same principle. In those situations, God delivers the righteous out of what is happening. And I'll give you a good example of God delivering the righteous out. Although I have some questions about this, I'll be real honest about this. Daniel, think of Daniel and his friends. You go, well, they got carried away to Babylon. Do you realize how they got put up? These guys weren't put in hard labor. I mean, if they wanted to, they could have been eating all the stuff with the king. And by the way, don't buy the Daniel plan. Have you seen this? Rick Warren and some other guys, they're selling a book. I mean, talk about Christians and silly books. It's called the Daniel Plan. You can change your life and learn to eat better and do these. You know why Daniel ate vegetables for those days? Because if he would have eaten the food that Nebuchadnezzar put on the table, he would have been eating food that was sacrificed to Nebuchadnezzar's gods. That's exactly what was going on. And he says, we're not going to do any of that. So we're going to just eat vegetables. And God supernaturally, not because it's a better diet, supernaturally gave Daniel and his friends better health. You practice that, you have no guarantee your health is going to be better like Daniel's. But for them it was because God was proving a point.
It said that they were fatter than, as fat as the other guys.
Yeah.
In that days.
Yeah. In other words, they didn't be, in other words, what he's saying is they didn't become skin and bones. And I think, what is it? Was it 40 days that they did that? Or 30 days or something that they did this thing?
Fatter. That's usually...
Usually don't become fatter eating a vegetarian diet, or yeah, just vegetables, yeah. But God did that with Daniel. Now, I said I had one question about that. And my one question is I sometimes wonder if Daniel and his compadres, if they didn't bear some complicity in what was happening and why Judah was taken away in captivity. But being in captivity, Daniel and his friends were some of the ones that were wise enough to recognize we've been punished because of what we did, which is why Daniel then in Daniel 9 confesses his sin and the sin of his nation, because it's precisely what God had indicated that they were to do when Solomon dedicated the temple. And Daniel doesn't say, my nation did this. He includes himself as being complicit in what took place. So, but I think that there was a degree of righteousness there.
He just finally get the scroll and read that, and then he goes, I need to do that, or did he...
I can't tell you that. All I know is that he was aware of what they were to do, and he does precisely, almost, it's interesting, as you look at his thing, it's almost word for word, it's just like he's going through the checklist of what Solomon said when they dedicated the temple. Check said that, check said that, check, and I don't think he's being flippant like that. I'm just saying, it's almost like there's a checklist with the way he goes through that. And we've done that study before. It's just been a while since we've done that. Maybe we should go back and do it again sometime. But
wasn't Jeremiah also spared?
And Jeremiah was spared, and some of the poor people of the land, and yeah, so he was spared. There's an example. But again, it's a demonstration that most of the people in Judah, they didn't listen to Jeremiah. They mocked him. So it's a demonstration that, yeah, there weren't many righteous. There weren't many at all. And I think, and think about that. How many prophets had not bowed the knee to Baal in the time of Elijah? 7,000. We think, well, 7,000, that's pretty substantial. Out of all the land of Israel, 10 tribes? I don't know how big they were by the time Elijah was around, what the population of Israel was at that time. But I was working on the study for this about when God brings them out. And the population, the men, the fighting men, 20 years old and upward, are 600,000 men. 600,000 men. That's at the time they come out of Egypt. Now you go on down the way about another 700 years, do you think that population is probably, you're probably talking about several million throughout that land. 7,000? Drop in the bucket. Anyway, okay, back to the main study. I digress. Pardon me. Okay. Turn to Ezekiel chapter 14, and there's a very important statement here in Ezekiel 14. And then we're going to answer part of Edward's question here. Chapter 14, Ezekiel chapter 14. And this is talking about the Babylonian captivity now. But what he says here is that the city was so evil at the time of the Babylonian captivity. Verse 12, then the word of the Lord came to me saying, son of man, if a country sins against me by committing unfaithfulness, that is breaking, literally the word is breaking truth in this case, and I stretch out my hand against it, destroy its supply of bread, can't eat, send famine against it, and cut off from it both man and beast, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it. It's in its midst. by their righteousness, telling us now that Daniel, whether he was complicit in that or not, as I said, he also had outstanding righteousness. Noah, Daniel, and Job, they could only have delivered themselves, declares the Lord God. He repeats the same thing again. Where is it? Down in verse 20, he says, as he's going on again, that even though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in the midst as I live, declares the Lord, they could not deliver either their son or their daughter. They couldn't even save their son or daughter. They could deliver only themselves by their righteousness. Okay? So appreciate that. Understand that. I don't know how you say appreciate that, but grasp that fact that when something becomes so evil, it can become so evil and permeated that even you can't, as he's saying, you can't even make your son or daughter be righteous and deliver them by your righteousness. We'd like to think we can, but he says you can't. Okay? Then turn over to Jeremiah. Last verses of the night that we'll look at, unless you guys have some questions. But Jeremiah 5. And this will kind of get to the point of more specifically answering the point, the Edward's question here. But in Jeremiah chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. Roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem and look now and take note and seek in her open squares. If you can find a man, if there is one who does justice, who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. I'll pardon Jerusalem. If you can find one, notice that, one. And although they say, as the Lord lives, surely they swear falsely. In other words, as the Lord lives, they'll do. They don't mean it, he says. The Lord, O Lord, do not thine eyes look for truth. You have smitten them, but they did not weaken. You have consumed them, but they refused to take correction. In other words, it's like dad taking the child and disciplining the child, and the child refuses to change. They persist. They have made their faces harder than rock. They have refused to repent. And they are only the poor. They are foolish. They do not know the way of the Lord or ordinance of their God. Remember, they're the ones, according to Jeremiah, that get left in the land, the poor. I will go to the great and I will speak to them. For they know the way of the Lord and the ordinance of their God. But they too, with one accord, have broken the yoke and burst the bonds. In other words, in other words, Jeremiah's point is, you could maybe say that the poor, because they lack education and they haven't got some of the training and the things of God, you could maybe say, yeah, they've done some wrong things just because they didn't know better. Isn't that what we hear today in our culture? Oh, they didn't really know better. They had bad upbringing. They came from the projects, you know. We get all that kind of stuff. And he says, well, okay, go to the well-to-do, go to the rich. Just as bad. Point being, you could find one, I'd spare the city. What's his challenge, Jeremiah? There's not even one in this city that makes this city worth sparing. Other than Jeremiah himself, obviously. That's telling you how bad it was at the time that God came there. And again, you're talking about Jerusalem being a city, a substantial city. We're not talking about royal city. We're talking about a city that's got a lot of people packed into those walls and a lot of people lying outside around the edges that when they had problems all ran inside and they shut the gates of the city. Okay. So what's the point as we're going to doing this, the big story as we're trying to look at this?
So when you dispersed them, it was for serious reasons.
Yeah. But what's the purpose we're looking at this tonight? We're trying to see that. See, when God came and intervened at the time of Noah, when God intervenes at Babel, when God intervenes at Sodom and Gomorrah, and we used some other illustrations here to look at this, we're seeing God did it when it degenerated to the point that as Abraham found, there wasn't even 10 in the city, not even 10 righteous people in Jeremiah's day. Can you find one, Jeremiah? Can you find one? I'll spare you if you can find one. Couldn't find one in the city. That's how severe this was. Now, was there another, I suppose, righteous man in Jerusalem with Jeremiah? Baruch is the secretary, but I don't know that Baruch was still around with Jeremiah. I think he probably was, but I think he's talking about, like, other than you and the guy that's writing your stuff down with you, you know? Can you go find somebody else out there? And we're trying to demonstrate God has intervened in history, and that's, I think, part of these three big stories. One of the things that we should come away with, what God's done at the flood, and it's interesting how close these all together in Genesis. You got Genesis 5 through 9, or 6 through 9. You've got Genesis chapter 11, and then you go over here to Genesis chapters 18 and 19. So all of those between really are happening between Genesis 6 and Genesis 19, all three of those big events. And I think all three of them are showing that God has been doing what? Dealing with all the world over here. And it got so bad there was really only one righteous guy left, Noah. And God rescued him and his kids. Okay? Then it gets so bad that God has to scatter those people over the face of the earth at the time of Babel. And then it gets so bad in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And remember, Sodom and Gomorrah are two cities that have influence over a vast area. It's not just that those cities were bad. It's that they had a vast area. Because they weren't the only places destroyed. It says those cities and the other cities of the plain, other cities that were in connection with them were also destroyed. But they were, it'd be like saying Seattle and the outlying cities, which would be Everett and Tacoma and Bellevue and all those other. In other words, all the outlying places. We're taking in all this too. And God does those. All of that is a buildup now. One more step in here. All that is a buildup that God's going to say, okay, I've been working in general with the world, and the world out there in the world, they just keep rejecting and rejecting and rejecting. What's God going to do then? What's God doing in the transition between Babel and in the time of Sodom? He's focusing now on one man and one family. And yet what we look at here with Jeremiah and Ezekiel is, even that one family that starts off as the focus of God's work, as they go out, they degenerate just like these nations, and God does what? Has to punish them too. But he doesn't punish them just because the first wrong thing they do necessarily. He does it when the majority reaches a point at which there's nobody really righteous.
But he tells them beforehand, you do this, this is your consequences.
Yes.
So he's showing that he warned them. He was fair. You do this, you'll get that. I mean, yeah. And he did what he said.
Okay. Any questions or anything else to add?
So, like in modern war, but not in modern war, like World War II, like you were mentioning earlier. Seems like God intervened in, use the United States to, and other nations to put down, the Germans. I mean, it appears, I don't know exactly all God was doing really behind the scenes there, but I'm assuming the similar thing.
Okay, that's right. You weren't here last week. Let's look at one last verse that just reminds us that this is still going on. Okay. Acts 17. We do have a verse that tells us that this is still happening to some degree. We're not saying it's as overt as the flood or Sodom, Gomorrah, Babel. Acts chapter 17, this is Paul on Mars Hill. Remember, when you read this, read it with discernment, because there's things he says, he kind of mixes some things together here. But he does make this... let's see.
26.
Is it 26? Thank you, Ben. He says, and he made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their times and the boundaries of their habitation. In other words, God has always determined how long any nation exists, and he's always determined where they exist. That is, how far they spread out. So as the Egyptian empire spread out, God limited how long that empire was going to be dominant, and then how far that he would let them control. And he did the same thing with the Babylonians, with the Assyrians, with the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans.
I think he does that with families too.
Well, I can't say that with families, but I can say that with nations, because I have a verse that says that about nations.
He controls, he's written down everything. So when you take to the the books that he's written down it before it's finished. He wrote the beginning and the end.
Maybe you need to explain to me what you mean by families, because I don't know. I guess I don't know what that.
Well, how big his family is, How many kids? He's already written it down. We have a choice. We go, but he makes circumstances happen where you go, I'm done at 3, or done at 8, or 10, you know, kids.
Okay, I kind of
how many
follow.
Kids? How many, you know, if, let's say I decided I wanted 5 stores in my head. That's nuts. But, you know, God, so I only determined one, then, and then I go out and try to do that. I could go bankrupt trying to do that. That you're done. You know, he determines things.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. Yeah, I think that there.
But some people go, oh, those are just nations. No, it's fine. Details.
Right, yeah, and we've got enough other scriptures to demonstrate that, yeah, there's a lot of details, all the details, really, that are involved in this. But the main point of coming to this passage was, first and foremost, to demonstrate or remind us that, yeah, God steps in, and you know, it's always easy to say on the winning side, well, you know, God was with us, you know. But that's really, to some degree, is true. Even when the United States, when we've gotten ourselves into trouble and we've gotten smacked in the nose and, you know, hey, we pulled out of Vietnam and we kind of left a little bit of a mess over there. Things didn't go very well, and maybe that was because God knew we were pursuing something he didn't want. He didn't want us to go that way, and God stepped in and intervened, and it didn't end in a good way. Things like that, just as an example. It's always easy to say we're always in the right, but in the end, it's not always about being in the right. It's about what God's determined for those nations. So yeah, I would say what God was doing back then, in some way, God's still doing it at the present time. It's just what we're looking at now is why God has actually set some of those boundaries. And I think a lot of those boundaries with almost all these nations really becomes, if you haven't done so, go over and read Daniel 7. Daniel 7, God looks at the nations and he looks at them as wild beasts. Fierce, vicious, wild beasts. That's the way God looks at politics and political nations. Wild beasts. Which is, the point is, they don't really care about the average guy. They're really about survival. That's what it comes down to. And God shows you, and there's a reason for that. We probably should go back and go through Daniel, at least briefly, because Daniel is very interesting for what it taught the Jews, but I think we as Christians learn a lot of key things from it too, and not just in terms of prophecy. So, okay, any other questions? Okay.